Word of mouth.
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 Well done.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's been a big shift in what's considered funny over the past decade or so. In that time, family-friendly sitcoms ground to a halt, and practical jokers like Tom Green and Johnny Knoxville took off. Meanwhile, popular shows like The Office and Modern Family did away with laugh tracks and added reality TV-style face-the-camera confessionals. At the Cineplex, the embarrassing antics of Borat pushed against the boundaries of taste. These days, comedy doesn't just make you laugh. It makes you cringe.
Do you send Ambassador Rodman to North Korea on your behalf? I read somewhere that you'd be sending Hulk Hogan to Syria. Or is that more of a job for Tonya Harding?
Zach, he's not our ambassador.
What should we do about North IKEA?
Why don't we move on?
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously?
Zach Galifianakis interviewing President Obama there in one of several awkward exchanges from the internet comedy series Between Two Ferns. Philip Maciak teaches film studies at Louisiana State University and writes the Dear Television column for the Los Angeles Review of Books. He's with us to explore how cringe humor became the norm. Philip, great to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me back.
First of all, we should probably establish a working definition for cringe humor. Do you have one?
Like any trend in media or any art of any kind, this isn't exactly a coherent movement. But I think that the thing that we can use to describe a lot of these different shows, especially the ones that you mentioned, is a focus on awkward exchanges and a focus on discomfort existing at some level, either between characters on the screen or even and especially between the show that you're watching and the viewer.
Well, what kind of factors, television shows, cultural changes, do you think pushed cringy humor into the mainstream?
Well, I've been reading a book recently by a professor named Jason Middleton who talks about this, and his argument, and I think this seems really right to me, is that this is coming out of trends in documentary, and specifically people like Michael Moore, people like Ross McElwee that focus on uncomfortable exchanges or embarrassing revelations. And I think it makes a lot of sense that the first kinds of shows that we see that occupy what we're calling cringe comedy are shows that really go for this kind of handheld realist or even documentary or mockumentary style. So things like The Office in the UK or things like Curb Your Enthusiasm in America. And I think that combined with the rise of reality television and that particular type of kind of fictionalized documentary style really brought out a desire in people for getting entertainment out of weird and uncomfortable exchanges.
We do have a clip of the British version of The Office. This, of course, the progenitor of the American version.
People see me and they see the suit and they go, "You're not fooling anyone." They know I'm rock and roll through and through. But you know that old thing, live fast, die young? Not my way. Live fast, sure, live too bloody fast sometimes. But die young, die old. That's the way. Not orthodox, you know. I don't live by the rules.
Ricky's your face there. Now, we did have an argument in the office about whether Seinfeld should be considered cringe comedy. What do you think?
I think it's cringy. I think it's certainly a progenitor. And, you know, part of the joy of Seinfeld is watching these people do awful things and be almost, you know, unselfconscious about that. I feel like Curb Your Enthusiasm as something that comes out of Seinfeld and that was written and stars Larry David, who was, you know, very much the one of the major creative forces behind Seinfeld, is really more of the is when the what was latent in Seinfeld becomes kind of actualized potential as cringe comedy.
All right, let's hear a clip from both Seinfeld, and we're going to compare it to what I would say is the undisputably cringy Curb Your Enthusiasm. Here's a bit from Seinfeld first.
Okay, cowboys, what'll you have?
I'll have the turkey club without the bacon. And I'll have the bacon club without the turkey.
George, don't make me get tough with you.
Why, you think you can beat me up?
You wouldn't want me to mess up that beautiful face of yours.
All right, now let's hear a clip from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Now here, Larry's getting slow service at a restaurant, so he gets up and gets his own food from the kitchen and is then confronted by the waiter.
Enjoying your meal?
As a matter of fact, I am.
Where did this food come from?
I brought it here.
Do you understand? I'm the waiter.
Yet we were the ones who were doing the waiting.
So we became the waiters.
This man is a hero. He just revolutionized the way restaurants work, my friend. No one's going to go hungry again.
Sorry, gentlemen.
What do you think sets these two apart, Philip?
I mean, I think there are obviously big, you know, aesthetic differences between these two shows. But to me, the kind of major difference that separates them is the laugh track. So on Seinfeld, you have this uncomfortable exchange going on, but you have a laugh track, or the presumption of a studio audience, essentially giving you permission to laugh, mm-hmm. right? Saying, what's happening here isn't mortifying, it's funny. Curb Your Enthusiasm, on the other hand, doesn't have that kind of guide rail for you. So you're watching something, and you're having a hard time figuring out whether it's mortifying or funny. And that's part of where I think cringe comedy comes from, is the audience having to decide whether something that they're watching is funny or just horrible.
Oh, that's so interesting. So the laugh track kind of gives us a little bit of an out from the cringe.
I think so, yeah.
Borat and Ali G, both from the brilliant mind of Sacha Baron Cohen, to my mind. 10 years ago, Tom Green. They're finding big laughs out of people's lack of awareness. Mm-hmm. Do you think cringe comedy is meaner? It's more mean-spirited than other forms of comedy?
I think it has the potential to be more mean-spirited. I don't think that it always is as a rule. What cringe comedy in this type of genre gives the creator is an opportunity to sort of guide the perspective about these people. And those creators, those writers, can either give us a generous perspective on these people who are behaving poorly or behaving awkwardly, or it can give us a kind of ungenerous perspective on those people. So I think that it allows for a more mean-spirited take, but it also allows for a really kind of humane take on human interaction.
We're speaking with Philip Masiak, who teaches at LSU and writes the Dear Television column for the LA Review of Books, about cringe comedy, the sort of evolution into cringe comedy, what makes it work, what makes it not work, and why. I think we've developed a taste for it in the past decade or so. Maybe one of the cringiest shows that I can think of is the Ali G Show. And this is Sacha Baron Cohen playing, you know, a very street level, doesn't know what he's talking about interviewer on a talk show, and gets a lot of mileage out of people not knowing that they are being duped. Let's hear Ali G.
So does vets mainly look after sick animals?
No, we do a lot of preventive medicine, reproductive work and everything.
Why was there so many sick animals in Vietnam?
There wasn't that many sick animals in Vietnam.
But weren't there like millions of Vietnam vets?
You're confusing terminology here. Okay, a veterinarian is a doctor of veterinary medicine. He's a person that treats animals.
For real. I was getting it. So loads of people went to Vietnam and then treated animals there.
No.
I haven't seen him for a long time, and he's just ridiculous. But here, the joke is on his lack of awareness.
Right.
You are watching somebody just bungle it so badly.
Right.
What works about this for you?
I think, I obviously love the Ali G Show, and Sacha Baron Cohen is amazing, but it makes me think of something that I think that Stephen Colbert once said. It was somebody from The Daily Show said that people will believe anything if you put them on camera, or they'll say anything if you put them on camera. And I think that's a kind of founding assumption of reality television and of cringe comedy as well. So in the case of the clip that you just showed, you know, if somebody just came up to you on the street, you would never believe that somebody was being this stupid. But because there's the authorizing presence of the camera, the person being interviewed sort of just buys in and plays in and will believe anything. And I think that what's so great about The Office, especially in the British version, I think this is even more true, is that you get the sense that this is a show about the decline and fall of this, you know, egotistical man that is brought about by the fact that a documentary crew enters into his office. That everything on this show happens and all of the sort of horrible and awkward things occur because this guy feels like he needs to perform for the camera. And I think the relationship between the subject and the documentary camera is really the kind of central relationship of cringe comedy.
I hear that a lot of cringe comedy is in the editing. Is that so?
I think that's probably true. I'm not as up on the production side of things, but certainly in something like the Daily Show interviews, the way that they do those, a lot of those reaction shots that you get when Stephen Colbert or Samantha Bee are asking ridiculous questions of these people, a lot of that's about editing and about taking responses out of context. I think it's also about capturing moments. I think one of the things that is really, really a crucial aesthetic detail of cringe comedy is the weight that's put on silences and things that aren't said. And so you have the kind of classic, meme of Jim looking at the camera in disbelief. And that's true, I think, throughout, is that there's this emphasis put on what isn't said or moments that are illegible or failed conversations. And so I think that in terms of thinking about editing, a lot of that is finding those small moments and having those be big laughs.
All right, Dwight Schrute, everyone.
Good luck.
That is a tough crowd. Blood alone moves the wheels of history.
You want the ground to swallow you up inside of those silences. Where do you see the trend of cringe comedy going?
A lot of people cite Louis or Girls as sort of examples of cringe comedy. And I think that that's true, but I think that they represent a slightly different version of it. And that is that it's really about self-effacement, right? Part of what Girls is about is exposure, and part of what Louis is about is sort of looking at one's own personal weakness, you know, giving a kind of naked portrayal, sometimes literally, of what it means to be Louis or what it means to be Hannah Horvath.
That is not my journal. Those aren't my feelings.
No, they're Hannah's feelings about your feelings.
No, Hannah knows nothing.
It is a journal! Why would she lie in the journal? That is the point, is not to lie!
Okay, I don't want to split hairs here, but it's actually not a journal. It's a notebook. It's notes for a book. Oh, so you want the whole world to hear all your valuable thoughts about my relationship? No, I'm just saying that I feel like journal implies like a 13-year-old girl who rides horses and obsessed with her mom. That's just not what I'm doing. It's not yours to write about, Hannah. It's my life.
There are a lot of cringes in those shows, but they're not the same as the cringes that you have on The Office or on Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's almost as if this is cringe comedy in the confessional mode. And it turns over into from comedy to drama pretty quickly and pretty easily.
Philip Maciek, thanks so much. A pleasure to speak with you again.
Thank you so much.
Philip Maciek there, assistant professor of film studies at LSU and Dear Television columnist for the LA Review of Books. Well, we may enjoy comedy that makes us squirm, but it is a much different story when experiencing that cringy silence ourselves. Coming up, we'll get schooled in keeping the conversation going. Stay with us for that and more on Word of Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Deep down, we know that there is more to human existence than polite, prefabricated exchanges about the weather or other mundane topics. So why is it that when we're standing online at the deli counter or on a plane stuck on the tarmac or at a cocktail party, we can think of absolutely nothing interesting to say? No need to stammer. Help is here from Chris Collin and Rob Baedeker, co-authors of What to Talk About, a guide for spicing up our conversational skills. And Chris Collin and Rob Baedeker, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I was wondering which one of you was going to talk first.
That's a big problem, isn't it, in conversation, especially when you have more than two people.
On the radio.
There's that awkward stall. So you've got to come prepared to put a foot forward and to offer something.
Well, we believe in breaking the don't talk about money rule. We believe in breaking almost every rule because saying the right thing is too much pressure. Saying the wrong thing is often far more interesting, and that's the point of conversation. We're trying to be interesting and memorable. Life is short. you got to talk a little more boldly.
Almost every rule? Are there any things that are just taboo you won't even touch?
We're just going to wait and see if you do that, and then we'll let you know if you said something horribly offensive.
Well, let's make it clear. You are not scientists. You're not motivational speakers, but you're academics. So who's your audience for this book?
Our audience, well, at first it was ourselves, and then it sort of became everyone when we realized that a lot of people shared our problem. We found that we were sort of panicking all the time, really. I mean, we're relatively smart people, especially me. And yet, you know, you find yourself in an elevator or on the seat next to someone on a plane, and you sort of panic over what to say. Or you have a really close friendship or a romantic relationship. You've been together or been friends for many years, and your conversations are sort of middling.
So you guys are really good at filling in those awkward pauses with some conversation starters or cold openings, as you call them. My favorite might have been, I bet your spirit animal is an attic raccoon. Sure to get a...
Virginia, that's your spirit animal, isn't it?
How did you know?
There's something, I think, in the voice. We're very intuitive. And
being intuitive is part of being a good talker. You've got to relax. Sometimes you have to close your eyes in a conversation, tune into your instincts.
And you're very resourceful, obviously. We just met you. But an attic raccoon has figured some stuff out, how to find a warm house. You know, this is a compliment.
Well, thank you very much, because I'm not sure if I feel complimented. But what are some of the other kind of cold openings that you guys have come up with?
Well, often we need conversation in these sort of glancing exchanges with the person at the cash register in the checkout lane at the grocery store. You know, Rob, what would you say to that person when you don't just want to say hi? How's it going?
I would say, you know, offer a dilemma to people. This gets the mind going in a different way. I would say, if you had a third eye in the middle of your back and you were online dating, would you mention it in your profile or would you wait for the first date? It really lets people open up.
Yeah. Does anybody look at you when you say something like that to them and maybe think, I don't think I want to talk to this person?
If that happens, you're doing something right. No, but in all seriousness, you know, we think it's okay to sort of go into weird territory every now and then. You don't want to be totally weird and have no friends. But in our experience, people are open to all sorts of things, far more than we think when we walk into a conversation. People want to go into left field every now and then because, you know, deep inside, we're all weird.
People do say, though, that they dislike small talk. You know, it's superficial, it's party talk. But they seem to do plenty of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, small talk is a great starting place. We don't dismiss small talk, but you gotta make it bigger. You gotta push further. So the classic small talk subject is the weather, right?
Right.
And how's the weather? It's cold, it's hot. Pretty finite category. But push that into big talk by asking a weather-related question. For example, what's the coldest you've ever been? Or what's the worst sunburn you've ever had? You take the weather and you push it into the realm of story. And now we're getting somewhere.
I guess that's sort of like approaching a good interview. You know, you don't want to ask people a yes or no question. You want to make them tell a story.
Right? Yeah, curiosity is key, right? And also admitting your own ignorance. Too often we're worried about looking smart or letting on that we don't know something. But if you can put your heads together with somebody, ignorance is fun. In other words, you can explore the question of what is wind? What is thunder? Speaking of weather-related topics, I kind of know, but I'm not totally sure. And if I pair up with a good conversation partner, we can have fun exploring that.
What exactly was the Korean War about? Could I really describe the difference between a democracy and a republic? You know, if you sort of expose your ignorance, we find that that's a great way to connect with people because then they can expose theirs and then you can sort of bond over how stupid you are. And that's sort of a sweet feeling. It's poignant.
You're talking a little bit also about how we reflect each other, right? There's a segment in the book on mirroring that our responses to small questions actually matter. So tell us about this mirroring phenomenon.
Well, mirroring is repeating blandly the same words or idea of the person you're talking to. We do it all the time, right? So it's a beautiful day. Yeah, it's a beautiful day. And the conversation just drops a transmission, so to speak, and all of its tires go flat. Instead of mirroring, we suggest taking the conversation to an unexpected place. So instead of it's a beautiful day, it's a beautiful day, it's a beautiful day. Yeah. Do you ever think about the fact that ghosts don't visit the gym? They go to creepy old houses, but you never hear about someone's deceased grandmother on the Nautilus machine. Why is that?
There's also a lot of mirroring that happens just in the most common conversation starter and killer, which is, hi, how's it going? And we mirror by even indulging that question, fine, it's going fine. And Rob and I are big advocates of answering the question that you wish had been asked. How's it going? You know, I've been thinking about the Chuckwalla lizard, which is a real lizard that can live without water. And pretty soon you're talking about what it means to live without water, how the scientists even learned this, and you can start talking about something more interesting than how's it going.
I'm speaking with Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker. They are co-authors of the book What to Talk About. This is for on a plane or at a cocktail party or in a tiny elevator with your boss's boss. What kind of things do you say? Okay, so you guys are talking about a lot of interpersonal stuff, but how about a party? Now, this is the sort of the nadir for people who are fearful of coming up with the right conversation. How do you prepare?
Well, one thing we recommend is preparing. You know, I think people are a little allergic to the idea of coming to a social situation with some kind of canned answer. You might seem like a phony or something.
But preparing, you mean like, you know, sort of in the bathroom mirror before you go, preparing some small talk?
Any mirror, bathroom, bedroom, car mirror.
They make tiny mirrors now you can actually carry around in your pocket.
But anyways, no, we mean, you know, having something ready to go in case your mind goes white and you absolutely can't summon a thought. And then it's fine to say, hey, you know, this reminds me of something I've been thinking about.
You use the word nadir, Virginia, which is a great word. And if I had nothing else to talk about right now, I might ask you about that word, which is an example of what we call a trigger word, pulling something out of the other person's sentence and being curious about it or taking it in a new direction.
Well, I wondered if I should have said nadir, actually.
I wondered, too. You know, that's something to talk about. How confident were you when you said nadir? You know, I think we all sort of wonder about these kinds of things all the time. Did I say it wrong? Oh, my God.
But I just took that risk. I guess I feel like I can talk with you guys.
The possibilities are proliferating here because you made an offer, what we call an offer. You took a little bit of a risk, and we were not afraid to expose our ignorance, and now we're talking.
Well, all right, I'm going to set the scene here. We're at a party, or you're at a party. You don't know that many people. Everybody seems to be insulated in impenetrable conversations. They're talking about nadirs or nadirs and fascinating things like that. So how do you break in?
Well, one thing that you can do is play a game. People like games. We're all children inside. Walk into a circle and say, okay, I'm just going to introduce myself. My name is so-and-so. Who would each of you be if you had to be cast in a movie? You know, who do we think we are? Are you the nebbishy accountant? Are you the sarcastic wisecracking friend? Are you the swashbuckling hero? And pretty soon you're not, you know, it's a safe topic. Everyone knows about movies. It's funny. But you're sort of introducing yourselves.
I've also liked the game that you've got in here called the versus game. So you can start a sort of debate with pie versus cake or Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah, everybody says Kramer. Everybody's got an opinion. That's one of the generous moves you can make is to ask people for their opinion. The versus game is a perfect way to do that. Everybody has an opinion about pie versus cake, and they've got a story about why they prefer one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Another thing to remember in a party situation is even if you just do horribly and you just everything goes south and you just say something stupid or you just stand there blinking awkwardly for a minute, we believe in the pay it forward model here at What to Talk About. You have just given these people something to talk about with the next person. They can talk about how disastrous this last conversation was.
And let's face it, it's pretty easy to move between states these days. You can pack up and get out of there if it really goes bad.
Are there benefits of this beyond just, you know, having a two-way conversation? How do we reward being a great conversationalist?
fame, money, relationships, experience, and
food.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, all the big moments in our lives, or most of them, involve some kind of talking. There's the job interview. There's the first date. There are the random encounters that turn out to form lasting bonds. They start with talking, and sometimes with small talk.
Facebook and Twitter are often dismissed as party conversation, as superficial conversation. Is the nature of conversation changing since we have Facebook and Twitter? Because, you know, there are a lot of provocative things that are put out in social media.
I think that they are great. They're wonderful. Anytime you're having a nice time and sharing pictures of your kids, that's great. But I also think it's good to be mindful of the ways that they are sucking the thoughts out of our heads, even when we're not aware. I mean, think about the last time you were waiting for your hot dog to finish microwaving. What did you do? You took the phone out of your pocket and you Instagrammed. It used to be that we would have thoughts pop into our head and the well of ideas would gradually replenish. And now we worry that that's not happening as much as it should.
On the other hand, you can hone your language, especially on Twitter, where brevity is a necessity. It allows you to sharpen your thoughts and you can recycle those in the real world.
Well, good to know. Thank you for that helpful tip and all the rest, Chris and Rob.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks, Virginia.
Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker. They are co-authors of What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss, all sorts of different situations. And if you'd like to be further convinced, you can watch a brilliant little book trailer for them. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
Don't you hate that?
Hate what?
Uncomfortable silences. Why do we feel it's necessary to yak about in order to be comfortable?
I don't know. That's a good question.
One way people try to avoid potentially awkward conversations is to avoid them altogether and communicate solely through clever posts and adorable pictures on social media. Problem is, if you want to stay connected to the cool kids, you have to go where they go and be ready to jump onto the platform of the moment. Producer Taylor Quimby wondered what happens to our old profiles when we move on to the next big thing. Turns out, not much.
MySpace. One could say it's the velvet leisure suit of social media.
Do you have a MySpace account?
MySpace, yes, I actually do.
Do you use it on a regular basis?
I haven't touched it in years, to be honest.
But it's probably still there.
Yes.
It's pretty normal to look back at old outfits and wonder, ugh, what was I thinking? History hasn't been kind to hammer pants or the fanny pack. And like the leisure suit, MySpace has suffered the same sort of fate. It's become a punchline.
Do you know anybody that has a MySpace?
Yeah, my dad has a MySpace.
But lest we forget, we're not talking about a trend from 15 or 20 years ago. In fact, it wasn't until 2008 that Facebook users first outnumbered fans of MySpace. Less than 6 years ago. MySpace was the hottest social media platform since Friendster. Remember Friendster? And even today, MySpace claims to have some 36 million users. But who are they? Do you have one? Did you ever have one? And when you decided to move on, did you delete your account?
All right. Let's see if we can find Taylor's MySpace.
That's producer Zach Nugent and my boss, Maureen McMurray.
MySpace.
So if you haven't already guessed, there's a reason I'm the one telling the story.
Okay, here it is. Oh, my.
That's Taylor. Yep. That's
oh, my God. What is going on here? Is that Taylor?
Around 2006 and 7, I was really into MySpace. And then, like many others, I abandoned it. I didn't delete my account, I just kind of drifted away. And since nobody I knew used it anymore, I sort of thought MySpace would just drift away too. But in 2012 and 2013, MySpace redesigned the site to focus on the one demographic still using it, musicians. They ditched the classic MySpace look, and all the blog posts, messages, likes and dislikes we agonized over, it all got sent to the digital trash bin. All of it except for one thing. The photos. Which means if you haven't deleted your account, its ghost is still there. And your leftover MySpace photos are up for the whole world to see.
Taylor, did you ever have a shaved head?
shaved head with ping pong balls as eyes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's you?
Brushing your teeth?
In the MySpace days, I looked a lot different.
And there's one of him.
As like the Joker?
Do you have blood on your face?
Frankly, I didn't use a lot of discretion when posting pictures.
Do we want to just describe this photo?
He's pantsless and he has an axe.
He's in a Speedo. He's in a straight-up Speedo.
My MySpace page was an extension of my musical alter ego at the time, an experimental project I called Milky Pink.
Like this, it looks like you're part of some cult.
It was pretty weird.
I don't know if you can read the caption underneath, but it says Milky Pink, murder capital of the world.
That was, okay, so the explanation here is that was the cover art for my first album as Milky Pink.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's you?
Yep. Now, none of this stuff is so bad it would ever get me fired, I think. But should I ever be looking for a new job, it's within the realm of possibility that an employer might see it. And the fact that it's just sitting out there for anybody with an internet connection to see makes me pretty uncomfortable. And work aside, I'm a dad now. I don't plan on hiding my past from my son, but I would like to be able to control how it's presented. So, here it is. The point of this whole story, how to delete your MySpace profile. Step 1. If you know the email and password to your old account, then congratulations. This is going to be a snap. All you have to do is log back in, go to your settings, and select Delete Account. If, like me, though, you don't have a clue what your email address was when you signed up for MySpace, or you signed up with a college email that's since been deactivated, it's a little more complicated. Before you can delete an account, you've got to prove that it's yours to delete. You need to sign the MySpace Declaration of Ownership. It's pretty easy to find once you know what you're looking for. To make it even easier, we've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org. But there is one tricky part. It requires that you attach a digital copy of a government-issued ID. Seriously. Once you've got that done, you can pretty much just fill it out and press send.
All right, I'm doing it, guys. Oh, wait. It's mad at me. What did I fill out here?
The form is going to ask you for all the information we have already established you do not have access to. So you've got to find a workaround, like I did.
Okay, maybe if I just fill out don't know for all those fields.
Yeah.
Yeah, hold on.
Okay, now you can press send. And from there, you're just waiting. For me, it wasn't very long. I actually got an email from MySpace the very next day.
Already?
Yeah, I know. Let's see what it says. Thank you for filling out the deletion form. I have scheduled the profile in question for removal. So I guess that was it. Please allow up to 72 hours. Dexter.
This is sincerely Dexter.
MySpace, more efficient than we thought.
My guess, Zach, is that like 90% of the staff is dedicated to deleting people's accounts at this point.
As it turns out, deleting your profile may not be the eye-rolling ordeal you'd imagine. And depending on what you find still there, if you happen to Google yourself, it could be a tremendous relief. So if you never deleted your old account, it might be time to do a little digital housekeeping. After all, there's really no such thing as MySpace or your space when it comes to the internet. It's everybody's space, for better and for worse. For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Now, you may not be able to find Taylor's MySpace page anymore, but you will find the link to the MySpace Declaration of Ownership form and much more on how to delete your account. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for Poetry for People Who Do Not Like Poetry. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and April is National Poetry Month. But let's face it, there are a lot of people out there who just are not interested in reading or listening or talking about poetry. Otherwise, average readers who are, for whatever reason, simply averse to verse. Well, we're going to see if we can change that. Victoria Chang is a poet, most recently of a collection called The Boss. She recently compiled for Huffington Post a list called 13 Poetry Collections for People Who Think They Don't Like Poetry. Victoria, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why do you think it is that poetry repels so many readers, many of whom probably haven't even given it a chance?
You know, I think it really starts in high school. And I think that, a lot of English teachers in high school, they're approaching it from a very academic standpoint. And I think that that continues, that sort of initially turns, kids off, and then they never return to it. And then a lot of the verse being published today, I think, is so much entrenched in academia, it's almost like poets are writing poems just for each other and writing books just for each other. And it really alienates, I think, the rest of the world. And then it's just hard to return to that entry point now with so many different media outlets and other things that, kids can go back to, like video games or the internet. And it's hard to, come back at it.
So you've compiled this list for those to dip their toe back in. First mm-hmm. poet on your list, Billy Collins, who you say is probably the best introduction to poetry for people who don't like poetry. Why so?
Well, it's just so accessible. And I think, you often hear this when you talk to people who don't read poetry or aren't interested in it. They always say that it's just too hard. I think Billy Collins is that, I call him the king of approachable and accessible poetry, because he writes in a way that just, it almost feels like you're reading a newspaper or something, but that, really easy. You don't have to, your mind doesn't get stuck a lot. You just kind of flows and your eye just moves as if you're reading fiction or an easy newspaper article. But he writes about things that are a little bit deeper. And I think that that makes him a great place to start. And, he's known for that, being sort of that accessible yet actually well-respected poet, even amongst, academic poets.
Here is Billy Collins reading The Best Cigarette from his collection Sailing Alone Around the Room.
The Best Cigarette. There are many that I miss, having sent my last one out a car window, sparking along the road one night years ago. The heralded ones, of course, after sex, the two glowing tips, now the lights of a single ship, at the end of a long dinner with more wine to come and a smoke ring coasting into the chandelier, or on a white beach holding one with fingers still wet from a swim. How bittersweet these punctuations of flame and gesture. But the best were on those mornings when I would have a little something going in the typewriter.
Billy Collins reading the poem The Best Cigarette. That's from his collection Sailing Alone Around the Room. Victoria Chang, how do you suggest readers take in a collection of poetry? Maybe just try one or two at a time, or do you read it like you might a novel?
Well, gosh, I think you can read it any way you want. Some people start from the beginning to the end. I used to do that, and because I used to think that, well, that's how the poet wanted you to read them, this collection of poems. And then I heard some other poets, just like Robert Haas is the poet in California, and he just tosses his poems up into the air and they land where they land. And so now when I read a book of poems, I don't even read the whole thing, and books can sit on my desk for years, and I'll just take one poem and just read it once in a while. Oh, I'll just read one poem before I go to bed, or maybe I'll read this other poem a year later. It to me now, it's kind of just whatever you feel like, however you feel. And I think the internet and the advent of all this new technology has sort of changed how we receive books, even especially books like poetry that don't necessarily need to be read like a straight narrative.
There are some collections here that are newer collections, some older collections. Lucille Clifton, Louise Glick is on the list, Frederick Seidel, a New York poet, very interesting one. Another poet on your list is Sharon Olds, who lives at least part-time here in New Hampshire, and I spoke to her last year about her collection Stag's Leap. She read the poem for which the book is named. Here is an excerpt.
I feel like his victim, and he seems my victim. I worry that the outstretched legs on the heart are bent the wrong way as he throws himself off. Oh, my mate, I was vain of his faithfulness, as if it was a compliment rather than a state of partial sleep. And when I wrote about him, did he feel he had to walk around carrying my books on his head like a stack of posture volumes, or the rack of horns hung where a hunter washes the venison down with the Sauvignon.
Sharon Olt reading from her poem Stag's Leap. That's from a collection of the same name. That collection largely about her divorce, extremely personal. You have another suggestion for someone who would be new to poetry to get to know Sharon Olt. What's your suggestion?
It's a book called Gold Cell. I think a lot of practicing poets often refer to Gold Cell as one of their favorite Sharon Olt books. And for me, it was one of the first poetry books that I bought. And it still sits, you know, in my bookshelf, and it was so precious to me that I actually wrapped it in contact paper. And so, yeah, it was just so, it was such a riveting entry into the poetry world because, like Stag's Leap, you're reading it, and it's almost, wow, that's just amazing that she can feel so comfortable writing about such personal things yet not turn the reader off. And you sort of feel that universality, even though she's so incredibly personal and honest. It's quite searing, actually.
Victoria Chang is with us. She's a poet who's written an article about some poetry books and collections for people who don't think that they really like poetry. Also on your list is The Half-Finished Heaven by Nobel Prize winner Thomas Tranströmer. I hope I'm saying that properly. Tell us a little bit about his work and what makes that worth reading for the poetry skeptic.
Well, Tranströmer's just this lovely poet that a lot of Americans have translated, and he just has this incredibly macro perspective and of what sort of why we're here and these greater kind of existential questions that I always find so interesting. Towards the end, I feel like he ends his poem so beautifully. I think in one poem he describes a newspaper like a dirty butterfly. And I always remember that image. I was thinking, who thinks of a newspaper as a dirty butterfly? And, you know, he does that again and again in all of his poems, but especially in that collection I really enjoy.
Well, you talked about tackling big existential questions, which may be precisely why people don't engage in poetry. It's frightening for them. And humor maybe is one of the best ways of winning over the poetry skeptic. And you suggest a collection that's pretty funny, although often quite shocking. It's called Letters to Wendy's. Can you tell us a little bit about this collection?
Oh, right. Yeah, Letters to Wendy's is written by a poet named Joe Wenderos, who published this book a while ago. But when it came onto the scene and the world, actually, it does border on pornographic, but it's so brilliant because he uses the metaphor of Wendy's, the fast food restaurant, which we've all been to, you know, with the Biggies and the Frosties and that red-headed Wendy's that stares at you with this blue and white striped dress. I mean, think of how rich or a minefield potentially all of these images could be in this collection of poems that he supposedly had written over a year on comment cards, you know, sitting at the fast food chain. And they're all these kind of prose poems, you know, just kind of loose little blocks of language. And it just, you can read those and you'll just be laughing out loud.
Well, we found a couple of the most innocent selections in the book and had our producer, Zach Nugent, read a couple entries. Here he is.
January 3rd, 1997. I've been sort of hesitant to mention this, but I believe one of your employees, you must know the one I speak of, is a beaver. It's impossible to look into her face, to hear the sounds she makes, and to see the way she moves, the way she carries bits of wood, and not feel that this is a beaver. I've not mentioned this before because, obviously, beavers are powerful creatures.
Producer Zach Nugent there reading from Letters to Wendy's. So these are all collections that you would recommend for the poetry novice. Any that you would suggest they avoid?
You know, I tend to avoid personally anything that feels too overly sentimental, too cliched. And, you know, I think for me, you know, a lot of poetry professors and teachers are always saying, read, you know, old collections, you know, things from a long, long time ago. And honestly, I've never loved really old poetry. And I know people recommend Emily Dickinson and all this kind of stuff, but I've never loved that kind of poetry. I like things that are more current, you know, maybe the last 20 or 30 years max. And especially for people who don't read poetry regularly, I would say, you know, you can just read current stuff, and it'll be more applicable to your daily life.
Victoria Chang, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Victoria Chang is a poet, and her most recent book called The Boss was published by McSweeney's last year. You'll find a link to read her full list of poetry collections for people who do not like poetry. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. April is National Poetry Month, and all this week we've been presenting recitations from some of New Hampshire's bright young high school students. All of them were finalists in the Poetry Out Loud competition held at the State House last month. It is by far one of my favorite annual events, watching those young people pour their passions and their theatricality into poems in front of a crowd at the New Hampshire State House's Representatives Hall. Here is our last featured poet, Amber Mercedes.
Amber Mercedes, sophomore, Coe Brown. The Strength of the Fields by James L. Dickey. A separation from the world, a penetration to some source of power, and a life-enhancing return. Van Genep, Rites de Passage. Moth Force, a small town always has, given the night. What field forms can be outlying the small civic light decisions over a man walking near home? Men are not where he is exactly now, but they are around him like the strength of fields. The solar system floats on above him in town moths. Tell me, train sound. With all your long lost grief, what can I give? Dear Lord of all the fields, what am I going to do? Streetlights, blue force, and frail, as the homes of men, tell me how to do it. How to withdraw, how to penetrate and find the source of the power you always had light. As a moth and rising with the level and moonlit expansion of the fields around and the sleep of hoping men. You, I, what difference is there when we can both be saved by a secret blooming? Now as I walk the night, and you walk with me, we know simplicity is close to the source that sleeping men search for in their home deep beds. We know that the sun is away. We know that the sun can be conquered by moths and blue hometown air. The star splinter, pointed and wild, the dead lie under the pastures they look on and help. Tell me, freight train. Tell me in a voice the sea would have if it had not a better one, as it lifts hundreds of miles away, its fumbling, deep-structured roar like the profound, unstoppable craving of nations for their wish, hunger, time, and the moon. The moon lying on the brain, as on the excited sea, as on the strength of fields. Lord, let me shake with purpose. Wild hope can always spring from tended strength. Everything is in that. That and nothing but kindness. More kindness, dear Lord, of the renewing green. That is where it all has to start, with the simplest things. More kindness will do nothing less than save every sleeping one and every night walking one of us. My life belongs to the world. I will do what I can.
Amber Mercedes, they're a 10th grader at Coe Brown Northwood Academy. You can see photographs of all of our guest readers and watch a video from the Poetry Out Loud competition at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we would like you to help us celebrate National Poetry Month, but do not have to recite anything from memory or write in quatrains. Instead, we invite you to create a public radio-inspired haiku. Here's one example. I can't spell your name, but I know your voice so well. Oh, great Kai Ristall. You can share your haikus on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter @wordofmouth. We are so glad you could join us today. I'm Virginia Prescott. On behalf of all of us here, have a happy Easter weekend. We will be back with more Word of Mouth on Monday at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.